Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Today on Truth and Movies, first up, the Star Wars saga comes to an end with J.J. Abrams' The Rise of Skywalker.
Long have I waited. And now, you're coming together.
Then the paws are strong with this one. It's Tom Hooper's big screen adaptation of Cats. And to finish, forget the Imperial March, how about the Family March? It's Greta Gerwig's take on Little Women.
I intend to make my own way in the world.
No one makes their own way, least of all a woman. You'll need to marry well.
You are not married, aren't you?
Well, that's because I'm rich.
All coming up in Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Hello there, movie truthers. It's the end of the year and it's Michael Leader here sitting in the host chair across from David Jenkins.
Hey.
And Hannah Woodhead.
Hello.
How are you all doing? It's the last episode of the year.
So very, very tired. Not really. But only because I was, because we went to see Star Wars last night that didn't finish till like 11:30. And then the review embargo was 8:01 this morning. Mm-hmm. So we had that 8-hour gap in the middle of the night to pen our reviews.
Well, it's a little bit inside baseball, isn't it? But there was something quite rare this week where they had back-to-back press screenings for Cats and The Rise of Skywalker. So 6:30 start for Cats, then straight out and run across Leicester Square into The Rise of Skywalker. Quite a night at the movies.
So I hadn't realised, maybe due to my ignorance, that the Cats world premiere was meant to be last week in London and they cancelled it.
Always
a great sign when
they
that happens.
They cancelled it.
Because the film wasn't finished. I mean, I don't know if anyone would have seen that video of Tom Hooper on the red carpet in New York saying he was finishing the film at 2 p.m. the day before the premiere.
I mean, you'll understand that I didn't make it to see Cats yesterday, but I always think it's a good sign when a filmmaker is making a film hours prior to its public release. I mean, you know, it's a good sign.
Yeah, it's not like he's had 2 years.
I'm guessing that you guys are going to factor that in.
We'll be talking about Cats very shortly. But before we move on to the films, any business to talk about, David? What's the lay of the land for the end of the year Little White Lies business?
Yeah, we've been sort of holding back on all our end of year material because I think we wanted to wait and see some of these big titles, which we have now done. And we will duly be revealing our top 30 films of 2019 on Friday. So if you downloaded the podcast on Thursday, then that's tomorrow. And then we've got a massive and really fascinating best of the decade list where we've got tons of our contributors who've sent in their top 10, and we've kind of polled a really big broad amount of people, and it's a really fascinating top 10, and we're gonna sort of reveal those as close to the end of the year as possible, or indeed the end of the decade as possible. So, and then after that, we've got a really cool preview of all the stuff coming in 2020. So it's kind of out with the old and in with the new. So
fantastic.
Keep eyes out for that.
And we are starting 2020 with a special screening, aren't we, Hannah?
We are indeed. I mentioned it a few weeks ago on the podcast, but for anyone who did not listen to that episode, you should definitely come and join us at the Prince Charles Cinema on the 9th of January at 8:45 p.m. for a screening of the Safdie brothers' Daddy Longlegs. They're, joint debut, I guess. Josh Safdie made a film called The Pleasure of Being Robbed beforehand, but this is their official first film together. It's fantastic. It stars Ronald Bronstein as this New York father who is kind of frantically scrambling to keep his life together. He obviously is now their co-writer and co-editor. And I think it works really well as a companion piece to Uncut Gems. So you can go and watch that and then hang around for a little live podcast with, I think the three of us are going to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. And we have a signed Uncut Gems poster signed by Josh and Benny Safdie to give away. So it's worth staying in your
seat. Very cool swag.
So only a couple of them, I think, knocking around. So yeah, definitely stay around. And,
wonderful. Hope to see some of your listeners there.
Whilst on the subject of cool swag, can I do some very brazen big pimping to all our listeners who still have yet to get down the shops and get all their prezzies in?
Okay.
Please do consider heading to the Little White Lies Christmas shop via our website. And we've got a lot of cool stuff. Books, games, magazines, prints. Subscriptions, prints, bags, badges. So anyone who has any vague interest in film or culture or art or just who you think is an interesting person, this could be an easy solution for you.
Fill your stockings.
I could be a madman, couldn't I?
You mean as in Mad Men, the
TV
show? Who knows, really, David, with some of the takes you've come out with over the years.
It's like I'm selling
literally like John
Kodak
Hamm.
Again. Yeah.
Like John Hamm is in the room right now.
We should talk about Star Wars.
I'm holding the whiskey right now.
We'll see how much of a madman you are, David. Let's kick off this week's new release chat up first with Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker. J.J. Abrams is back in the director's chair for Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker, the ninth episode in the saga 42 years in the making, in which the surviving resistance forces face the First Order once more. A clip from The Rise of Skywalker there. We should say, of course, if you're at all spoiler-phobic, we're not going to go into spoiler territory, but if you want to get in completely clean while you're listening to a podcast, the conversation will still be here once you've
seen
the film.
Pause the podcast, go and see the film, come back. We're not going anywhere.
Can I just say, like, I'm very immune to spoilers. Before seeing this film, I hadn't seen any trailers, hadn't seen any clips of it, hadn't read anything about it, hadn't read any of the interviews with the cast and crew. They're the real spoilers. The pre-game marketing is the spoiler stuff, not the actual film itself. So, I'm 100% fresh on this.
And? Were you excited to go into this one, David? Where were you on Star Wars?
Okay, a short history of Star Wars for me. I never really got on with the original trilogy. When I saw the prequels, I was not very impressed with those. I since rewatched them and actually think they're quite interesting and intriguing and mad. I really liked The Force Awakens as a kind of bolt of nostalgia. I really liked Last Jedi because it's actually like a proper piece of filmmaking. It's a film where a director has sort of taken a franchise property and tried as best he can to imprint his name on it. And I think, you know, largely successfully. And this new one is the kind of, I think it's, I mean, even a film like Empire Strikes Back, the one after that,
Return of the Jedi.
Return of the Jedi, which is kind of, you know, the one that's sort of shrugged off a bit as the sort of silly one.
Right.
I really like that film because I think it, at the very least, it has its own enclosed storyline. It goes all in on the Ewoks, and you know, you're there in the shit with the Ewoks. Whereas, like,
in the shit.
Well, you
all
are.
In.
It's
George.
It's Ewoks all in. That was the original title, but this new film is kind of the ultimate in bland wiki score setting. It's like taking loose threads, tying them up, and saying, "Look, we tied them up." And it's quite a slow. It's not a car crash, but it's just a sort of slow. It's quite a slow burn realization of like, oh dear, they're doing this, aren't they? We're kind of joining our regular gang of, you know, Rey and Finn and Poe, and they're in the Millennium Falcon and they're flying around and they're going to places and they're doing things and picking up trinkets and unlocking secrets and finding clues and engaging with monsters and using special powers and yada, yada, yada. And then it ends up being quite a sort of bureaucratic film in a way, in that it's just like we're sort of closing up shop, you know? We're going to end things on in a very sort of neat, diplomatic, cordial, friendly, nice way that nobody can complain about, but at the same time, nobody can really get excited about.
Mm-hmm.
It's the kind of very bland, non-offensive, happy, joyful, just nothing Star Wars movie, in my opinion.
I think it's impossible to watch this film as any sort of engaged fan, be that a film fan or a Star Wars fan, and not see this film as a course correction after the way The Last Jedi was received by some quarters of the Star Wars community.
I mean, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that obviously the film is not out until this Friday and it's going to be a big movie, whichever way you slice it. But, you know, Solo didn't bring in the bucks. Mm-hmm. And that was the kind of like, oh dear, maybe we're not completely bulletproof in terms of like, you know, our kind of assured commercial reach for these movies. And frankly, it's a hard film to think that there's going to be fans wanting to go back and re-engage with it. It's very kind of WYSIWYG, you know. it's right there for the taking. No ambiguity. No sort of like, I don't know. Maybe the absolute hardcore might want to go back and see a few little kind of callbacks or references that are thrown into the mix. I'll admit that there were. At the screening we all attended last night, there were a few moments where there were sort of moments of applause for things that didn't make much sense to me. They were like, you know, someone gives something to someone and there's a big like, "Ray!" And I'm just like, okay, fine, that's cool.
As somebody who got that reference, this felt like a film where J.J. Abrams is trying very hard to please the audience. And a lot of that is just digging into his Santa's bag and saying, here's a bit of fan service, here's a bit of pandering. And there are many of those cameos, callbacks, maybe references to some deep part of fan community lore. It's all there, and it really tries. You mentioned audience reaction. There were pockets of cheers, but nowhere near the scale of what would happen in a Marvel movie when that happens.
Mm.
And it really was quite marked to me, the proportion, the smaller proportion of the audience responding. And it just feels that Star Wars just can't reach those heights of everything coming together and paying off in the way that the Infinity War films did. Hannah, you were a big Last Jedi fan, right?
I was indeed. I gave it a rave review on littlewhiteeyes.com 2 years ago, and maybe even on this podcast. I can't remember who did the podcast, but still, I stand by it. When I interviewed Rian Johnson about Knives Out, I had to be very like cool, calm and collected rather than just being like, I love your movie so much. I love what you did for Star Wars. So yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people, when J.J. Abrams came back, a lot of the Last Jedi denouncers were very like, yes, finally, J.J.'s back. He's going to guide this ship home. And I was like, oh no, he's going to undo absolutely everything that Rian Johnson kind of worked really hard to set up and make. It felt like The Force Awakens was kind of rebooting this universe, bringing us back in, and then The Last Jedi was taking us to a new kind of galaxy and somewhere exciting. And it's kind of like, wow, where are we going to go now? You know, this film has kind of ripped out the pages and started again. That's why I really liked it. It felt like someone was trying something new.
Mm-hmm.
And I think The Rise of Skywalker is course correction, but in a very kind of boring autopilot. Nothing is exciting or fresh about this film. It's all just shut up and play the hits, which I think a lot of fans probably wanted.
Can I give you an analogy that I've just thought of?
Oh, here we go.
It's like J.J. Abrams is the teacher who sticks really rigorously to the curriculum. And Rian Johnson has come in as the kind of mad supply teacher who's like taking you out on the field, going down the shops, field trips, all that kind of stuff. And then they've looked and thought, oh no, they're too overstimulated. Let's get J.J. Abrams back to like force the curriculum down their throat again so they pass their exams.
It's Dead Poets Society, yes. And Ryan is Robin Williams. And I'm standing on the desk.
You're standing on the
screaming,
desk, right?
Captain,
now.
My captain.
We can't go too deep into this film, but can we talk about maybe what was in The Last Jedi that maybe hasn't travelled over here and what they're bringing back from The Force Awakens?
I think the sense of risk in The Last Jedi, not just in a kind of what Rian Johnson was doing, but within the plot, like the stakes and the fact that characters were allowed to make mistakes and things didn't always pay off. And they, you know, I think Poe Dameron in particular in The Last Jedi, he makes poor choices and he has failings. I think all the characters actually in Last Jedi are allowed to kind of be human and fallible, and they can't just wave their hand and everything is fine, which is what I would say happens a lot in Rise of Skywalker. This film felt so unsatisfying to me as someone who really liked the other two films and felt there was a really great, interesting character arcs. And this one really kind of, it's not so much that it undoes the work, it just doesn't do anything. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that so many characters kind of just grind to a halt in this film. You know, their motivations and their growth just doesn't go anywhere. It just feels like they stop. Everything kind of stops. And I think in particular, some of my favourite characters maybe didn't get the kind of satisfying conclusion, what I would think is a satisfying conclusion. And I think as well, like, there's a big plot point in this film, which I won't spoil, but I think it just kind of is a real... I'm trying very hard not to word this in a way that will spoil it for anyone, but I think it's very disingenuous what J.J. Abrams does with a very central relationship to this franchise. But, you know, I mean, in terms of the good stuff, there's a lot of Oscar Isaac in this film. I think he is so magnetic as an actor, and I think he's kind of struggled in general to find good roles since Inside Llewyn Davis. But Poe Dameron, I think, is one of the better ones for him. He really is this kind of, you know, I think he has the same, like, Harrison Ford energy. Mm-hmm. He's very, very charming.
He looks even more like Indiana Jones in this one than any previous film, doesn't he?
You know, if they're going to make another Indiana Jones, give him the call. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a no-brainer.
I think that's one thing you can't really criticise this film for, because also it wasn't this film that did it, but they cast that new generation quite well.
Oh, I know, totally. I think that even Daisy Ridley, who I don't think is the best actor in the world, I think, you know, she really has, like, kind of carried it. She has to, because the whole film is, you know, even more so, I think, than the original trilogy, where I think it felt a little bit more equal between Han, Leia and Luke. I think that Rey really is, everything is, like, centred around her and, like, her abilities and her heritage, which has been this big looming question. I do think John Boyega maybe gets a raw deal here. I don't think he has as much to do in this film.
I think he's one of those characters that had more to do in The Last Jedi, and they're not sure what to do with him in this one.
Yeah.
And he's a fascinating actor. I still haven't really got a handle on his on-screen persona. Of course, such a breakout star of Attack the Block. He's the person that probably fits most awkwardly into the franchise's new hyper-earnest but quippy tone, which I think Oscar Isaac manages to just effortlessly navigate.
I think he's definitely got that kind of, like, 70s, you know, certain sort of, like, charm about him, Oscar Isaac, bless him. But, I mean, Richard E. Grant as well. You and I were singing his praises. I think it's a shame he came to this so late, because he would have been a great villain.
So, like, he plays baddie general number 55, and he is just, he's so syrupy, and he's just dripping with...
He's eating it up, and I'm eating him up, eating it up.
If he was born 10 years earlier, he would have been all over that original trilogy, and he's having the best time, I'm sure, as the sort of foil to Donald Gleeson as well.
I think his presence is the only thing in the film where you think it's kind of combustible. You think anything could happen here.
Yeah.
You know, like, he is the sole presence in the film where if he's on the screen, you're kind of thinking, well, I'm not entirely sure where this is going to go and how he's going to turn out.
Yeah.
And I think, to sort of underscore what you were saying, I think the performers are doing their best with what they've got, but the reality is they just haven't got very much. I mean, the script really puts, you know, character work and development and emotion on the back burner in favor of, like, really dense plotting and, you know, like logistics of getting A to B and making sure everyone ends up in the same place at the same time, that you just, there's no pause for breath in this film. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, is it 2 hours, 2 hours 20 or 2 hours 30?
Yeah, 2:20.
So it's 2 hours 20 and you could have easily stretched it to 3 hours and had a few pauses or moments of contemplation that you just do not get here. And I think, you know, Rian Johnson's film as well, one of my sort of fond memories of it is that there was a sense of dynamics of like, mm-hmm. There was a big epic scene and then a big quiet, and then a kind of quiet scene of talking and actually, you know, talking about things and issues. Whereas like this, you just like the talking happens simultaneously with something else, or the communication is done through other means mm-hmm. that are maybe less interesting. I mean, one of the things one of the sort of really strange things I found about this film, I don't know if you guys agree, but in terms of the storyline and what it's, you know, what it's trying to do, it's quite convoluted in that they're going around to these various places, and a lot of the script is people trying to like explain to a potential younger audience what's happening. And by the end, where you have the big kind of, you know, there is a sort of big showdown at the end, there is a character who says the same thing about 6 or 7 times to basically get across the stakes of the film. Because essentially, you otherwise wouldn't get that. You're at the big climactic moment of 9 films, and you're at a point where they need to shout at you about 6 or 7 times, this is why you should be interested.
So perhaps doesn't trust its audience in the way that Johnson did with Last Jedi, and they're fearful of that happening again, leaving those gaps for interpretation where they were burned from certain online discourse.
One of the things that I think I wrote in my Last Jedi review is that Star Wars has always been quite good at dealing with, or the new trilogy certainly, the first two films I think were very good at dealing with like moral shades of grey and kind of ambiguity, and I don't think there's any ambiguity in this film. It's very didactic. It's like, this is where we're going, this is how it is, and these are the good guys and these are the bad guys, and this is all heterosexual romance as well, which I just had to throw in.
You've got to throw that in
well
there.
Well, just because J.J. Abrams himself dug himself into a hole by saying there will be queer representation in this film, and there is for
what
2
seconds. What about the gay Ewoks?
Back to the Ewoks, David.
The Ewoks.
David, what scores would you give Rise of Skywalker in anticipation, enjoyment, in retrospect?
So anticipation, you know, I would probably say it's a 4, despite probably being quite cynical about them before I saw them. I ended up actually really, I've really liked all the sort of new Star Wars films I've seen, including Rogue One, which I think actually now is a film that it's because it's so focused on a single plot, actually is so much better for it. It's a simple thriller, and it's a film that I'd be much more excited to revisit than maybe one of these sort of canon films. And then it's probably just a 2. It's like for enjoyment, it never does anything necessarily terrible, or it's never like outright bad, but it's never good. There is never a moment which just leaps off the screen. And I mean, you know, Rian Johnson, he gave us some memorable scenes and memorable images, and this does not give anything memorable. Like, I mean, it's a very, very forgettable film. So 4-2-2 for me.
Hannah?
Yeah, probably similar. I do disagree with David in that I think there are things in this that are outright bad. And Michael was sat next to me, and I am sure he will fondly remember the moment when I said, "Oh God!" At one
you didn't
scene.
Say, "Oh God." It was "Oh redacted."
There's one very. I knocked a cup over in frustration. There's one very late scene in the film which I think is just, well, I've already hinted at that. I think it makes no sense and is stupid and shouldn't be in it, but anyway, so it was like a 4 in anticipation. Mm-hmm. You know, I also had that sense of fatigue where I was just like, let's just get this over with, let's just all like clock off, you know. And same with Avengers, you know, I'm just like, come on now, let's do it, let's get this part of our lives done. And then yeah, probably, it really pains me to be giving a Star Wars a 2 and a 2, but I just can't see myself watching this again. I feel so kind of let down and deflated by it. And talking about memorable scenes, you know, I the last time I watched Last Jedi was 2 years ago. Like, I watched it twice when it came out in cinemas, and I can still remember so much of that film so vividly, you know, the throne room scene and the casino scene and the when the ships are all landing with the red smoke and everything. I can all remember this so vividly. Couldn't tell you half of what happened in Rise of Skywalker, what that film looked like. And I only saw that 12 hours ago.
Maybe last note here, I'm genuinely fascinated to see what the quote-unquote online community make of this one. Because it would be kind of hilarious if they got mad at it and did their whole, like, continue doing their whole we need to take claim of the Star Wars IP and make our own movies to correct this trilogy.
Like, I mean, the thing that annoys me most about the online community is that this film is, if people don't like it, it's going to be Rian Johnson's fault. They will make it Rian Johnson's fault.
Some people have already said that. They've teed it up, haven't they, as Last Jedi left them with nowhere to go.
Which is just... It's not even worth a rebuttal.
I'm very willing to hear from those people to see what they make of this film. If they like it, if they find something in it, you know, fair play to them. I'd love to hear from them and send us emails and tweets. You know, at truthandmovies@tcolondon.com via email. You know, we'd love to hear them. But for me, oh, I love Star Wars. I really do. I really did. And this is the film that makes me think that maybe as a film franchise, it's like X-Men, where you get one or two good films and then on the macro scale, it's badly managed. No one knows what they're doing. And in the end, it just doesn't amount to anything.
I haven't yet seen The Mandalorian, which I might watch over Christmas.
Well, when it officially is released
in Europe, early January,
when Disney Plus comes out. I hear good things about it. There's a baby Yoda in that.
There's a baby Yoda. There's Pedro Pascal.
I'm just going to retreat into the comics and the books, as I always
do. Freddie Prinze Jr. in the cartoon version.
Exactly. Star Wars Rebels will live on. Anyway, that is Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker. Let us know what you think about it if you do see it, and you probably are. It's the big movie of the season. But next, we're going to talk about the other big movie of Christmas, Cats. In Tom Hooper's big screen adaptation of the long-running Andrew Lloyd Webber musical, a tribe of cats called the Jellicles must decide yearly which one will ascend to the Heaviside layer and come back to a new Jellicle life. A nice blast of cats there. Hannah, you and I saw this last night. David, you had to miss out.
I did, unfortunately.
So do you want to take the wheel for this one?
Yeah, no, I'd love to. I mean, you know, Tom Hooper, personal arch nemesis of mine, so always interesting to see what he's up to, you know, keep tabs on his crazy schemes. Obviously, he's sort of became famous with King's Speech and Oscar glory, and then has sort of like pivoted into show tune IP film adaptations with his unwatchable Les Miserables. So this is Cats. You got Andrew Lloyd Webber, you've got Tom Hooper, you've got show tunes, you've got the recipe for maybe the worst film of all time on paper. We'll get to you in a minute, Hannah. I know you've got things to say about this. Let's start with Michael, what's your relationship with the Cats saga?
So I've gone throughout my 30-odd years of life not knowing anything about what Cats was about. I knew it was based on a T.S. Eliot bunch of poems. I knew that there was a dirge of a song called Memory that was a hit in the early 80s. I knew that it ran for a long time. But it wasn't an Andrew Lloyd Webber musical I knew much about. And so I had no idea that basically it's a bunch of cats just singing about their life, eating food out of rubbish bins or skulking around Soho. It's not my thing. I'm not a musicals person. I've said that on a few episodes recently where we've covered musicals. So I don't even know if the good version of this film would have been my sort of jam, but this was definitely not my jam. It's a massive, ugly film. People might have seen stills or the trailer.
Go through ugly, because, I mean, are you referring to the digital fur technology here?
Well, the technology. Well, they've spent a lot of money on this film, but you wouldn't really be able to tell. The actors do go through this transformation through the digital fur technology, but it just looks weird. It looks
DFC.
Like DFC. DFT, even. They have just pasted their faces onto these bodies where they're still human in shape and you can still almost see human anatomy moving underneath this fur. They have feet with toes and hands with fingers.
Do you feel that disconnect between like face and body then?
At times, it feels like you know the movie Ex Machina where Alicia Vikander's face was pasted onto a cyborg body. It felt a bit like that at times, but the most unnerving moments were where you could almost see, well, let's just say there's one moment where Idris Elba disrobes and you see full dad bod. And it's strange, very strange. Seeing fully nude actors as cats, strange, very odd. But the ugliness is also in the setting, the production design as well. It's a very they trace out a certain area of London between Trafalgar Square, Leicester Square, and into Soho, which is quite recognisable to some of us, particularly us, where we'd literally just walk through that location to go into the cinema. The Statue of Eros is a key location, as are the lions at Nelson's Column. But then there's this sort of corner, which is deepest, darkest Soho in a early 20th century setting when it's still a bit of a red light district type area, theatre district. And it just looks ghastly, it really does, as they sing and prance about. And if singing and dancing is the sort of thing that sets you on edge, don't go and see this film, is my conclusion. But I really am not the person to ask about whether this is a good version of Cats. That's the Cat correspondent's job, really, and I think Hannah's made a good fist of marking herself out as that.
You know, Hannah is a one-person industry in Cats' interest, shall we say. On the release of the first trailer, he did a lengthy FAQ tweet about all the, with mini profiles of all the cats to, you know, help people make sure they're not making a mistake about, you know, what they're going to be getting with this film. And considering your, you know, what I understand to be a genuine and sincere love of this property, do you think Tom Hooper has done it justice for you?
I think that Tom Hooper should be tried in The Hague for crimes against humanity. A little bit of a story for the dear listeners of Truth in Movies. I saw Cats in the Sheffield Lyceum when I was about 7 or 8 years old, and my grandma took me, and I thought it was the best thing I'd ever seen. I was on an aisle seat. If you ever go and see Cats, the stage show, they come through the audience and they have like little cat like lights, and it's all very like amazing. If you're
do you think they'll do like 4DX versions of
Tom
this
Hooper's
film?
Going to be crawling through the audience.
cat friendly screenings, they should do.
They should do cat friendly screenings, because at least then you'd have a cat to pet instead of watching the terrible movie. Anyway, so I saw this on stage and I thought, oh my god, this is amazing, this is what theatre is, I love it. I want to sign me up, I'm here for the long haul. And Cats was my gateway drug into Stephen Sondheim, into other Andrew Lloyd Webber. Like, you know, I like Phantom of the Opera. I don't like Starlight Express, but personal feelings about Andrew Lloyd Webber as a person aside, I do like quite like. I have a bit of affection for his musicals. And yeah, I think Cats, as a cat lover, as someone who thinks that cats get quite a bad rap, I like Cats the musical. I think Memory is a great song. I've sang it many times. I don't think it's a dirge at all. I love T.S. Eliot. Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats is one of my first kind of books that I read as a child, reading on their own for the first time. Genuinely 100% sincere. That being said, when the first trailer for Cats dropped, maybe there are some people out there who read my thread on Twitter and thought that I was genuinely very sincerely thinking this was going to be a good film. At no point have I ever thought that this would be a good film. I thought it would be entertaining, and it was, just not the kind of entertaining where I can, in good conscience, tell people to go and spend money to see this film. I would not recommend people pay to see this film. I would recommend they maybe get drunk on mulled wine and, you know, if they've got nothing better to do of an evening, go and see this film. But, I mean, everything you've said so far, Michael, I completely agree with. It is an ugly abomination of film. It is terrifying, yet also, like, deeply boring at the same time.
Can I just hold you on a note this moment?
Yes.
I'm interested in the ugliness. Can you kind of drill deep into the nature of that ugliness?
So the we talked about it on this podcast a few weeks ago, in fact, when we discussed 6 Degrees of Separation, a plot point in which they discuss that Sidney Poitier is going to make a film version of Cats, and the conversation. In fact, Ian McKellen is in that scene having this conversation. He's in this movie of Cats. How would you even do a film of Cats? When you're in a theatre, when you're in a proscenium arch, you can believe that these people wearing leotards with tails pinned on, running up and down the aisles, are cats. But when you're trying to create a fully realised world around them, you have to think about things like scale. You have to think about where the humans are. And it all feeds into that. The opening shots where you see what is recognisably humanoid creatures walking around where traffic bollards are double their size, but they're walking on their hind legs at some points and then on their paws. It's just visually confusing and doesn't ever look right. And then they've tried to do to turn Leicester Square into this sort of neon-lit, visually resplendent world where all of the signs are based around cat puns.
Apart from one very big one.
A very strange bit of product placement for Bovril in this.
Yeah, the big Bovril.
My favourite food.
All of the stage shows and all of the adverts up in lights are cat-related, so there'll be, of course, the Mousetrap, etc., playing in those theatres. And then suddenly...
Big dramatic scene.
Big Bovril.
Then big Bovril.
To hear that, I genuinely love Bovril, and that would make me want to see the film.
Also, the ugliness as well, though, is that Tom Hooper non-aesthetic, where it's there for, I quite like The King's Speech, to be honest. I don't love it, but I enjoy parts of it. But it's a very ugly film, and his camera work is strange. Where in this one, it's a CGI 360 wonderland, and he's still adhering to shaky handheld camera, where we can't really tell. There's a fantastic dance sequence happening with some real, you know, top-notch dancers, but we can't get a handle on the scene. It's very disorientating.
Pure sort of CG nightmare, or is there any kind of practical stuff in it?
No, I think this is the greatest disappointment, is that, you know, you go and see the stage show, and that one of the great joys of the stage show is the costumes and the makeup, and you can kind of tell which every cat is because they have a costume and they have very specific markings. And the set in the stage show is literally just a big, like a rubbish dump. That's it. Unless you kind of, I guess when it's a film, you have to flit around a bit more, make it a bit more interesting for the viewer. But I can't fathom the decision to make all of it CGI. I really think that this is a film where they just needed to do great costumes and great makeup. Because every cat just looks exactly the same. Because when you have these big wide shots with loads of them, you can't tell. You can't tell which is which. Mm-hmm. And it all just looks so fake and a bit shit.
Fake in a way that this should be a spectacular film. This should be visually exciting. There should be a real vision behind it. If this was Baz Luhrmann's Cats, for example, and Tom Hooper isn't Baz Luhrmann, as we know.
There's no opulence, and that's what they're going for. Because Cats, the musical on stage, is not an opulent production, but this is what they've sold this as. You know, all the marketing, they've got like branded Tattinger for this film. Cats branded Tattinger. They're like, have a lovely evening, come and watch the Cats, the movie. And it just all feels really cheap. I said to Michael yesterday, it looks like a unfinished graduate CGI film. That's what it looks like to me. All those weird Snapchat filters that turn you into a cat. It looks so... I don't know how much money was spent on making this, but it's impressive to make it look so like they've put no work into it.
But maybe that was a conscious decision, so they could have that sort of Snapchat social media crossover occur more easily. Now, I want to quickly get a little note in about the music, because my mother, she in our car when I was young, I've got a little story, little cat story. She would rock the original cast recording of Cats on tape, and I'm pretty sure it got like jammed in the tape player. So that was like
amazing.
That was it. That was it for us. And I always remember it was like, you know, it was quite quaint that you could hear the orchestra a bit, and you could hear the echo of the room a bit. And I haven't heard any of the new versions of the songs in this film, but would I be right to assume that they're kind of auto-tune atrocities?
I don't think there's not much auto-tune on that.
I think they are, like everything else in this film, like totally kind of soulless. Mm. The only one I will give a shout-out to is Taylor Swift does the McCavity song. And she... I was talking to a friend of the pod, Simran Hans, about this. The huge musical theatre energy that Taylor Swift brings to that 3-minute scene. She has clearly studied. She has clearly trained for this. She's only in it for 3 minutes. She literally comes in, does her song and leaves, which is totally fair. But she, I think, is genuinely very good. And she has the vocal range. She has the kind of like the choreography down. That in isolation is fine. The rest of the scene and the kind of the way that propels the plot forward, I think, is ridiculous.
So, would you say Taylor Swift's your top cat? What's the ranking?
I think her performance is very good.
Let's not rank. Let's go top cat. And I want to hear the bottom cat.
Okay, so the top cat, I think, is Ian McKellen as Gus the theatre cat. He genuinely, you know, we were saying this yesterday, when you pay for Ian McKellen, you get Ian McKellen. And he is very good. He's playing this kind of old shambling, his best days are behind him theatre cat, like reliving his glory days. And it's very sweet. And then I think also Jason Derulo, must say, Rum Tum Tugger, I think he's great. He does a Cockney accent. I think
Derulo?
Derulo does a Cockney accent.
Yeah.
And I think he's great. Bottom cat, James Corden and Rebel Wilson tied. Absolutely terrible. Just absolutely not. Just no. That's my view of those two.
Comedy cats.
They're the fat comedy cats. Two. Not one. Two cats that their entire personality is fat.
I'd say Ian McKellen's hot cat for me. Bottom cat, more out of cringing in my seat for this particular actor, Ray Winston as Growl Tiger, who's just there to scowl and talk in the strongest Cockney accent he's ever attempted on screen.
I enjoyed that. I don't know why he was there. I don't know what.
I'm getting general enjoyment vibes from you.
Like, quite spirited.
I mean, you know what? Like, I'd much.
You
rather...
said war crimes in the Hague.
Yeah, no,
he's getting off.
It is.
He's getting off and getting compensation.
It is a war crime, but at the same time, I'd much rather sit through Cats and have something to say about it than sit through Star Wars and have no emotion whatsoever. Cats, I think, is like everything that is wrong with cinema. But I can't deny that it made me feel something. It made me feel horror and fear and disgust.
I was sitting right next to you, Hannah.
But when I came out of it, there was a sense of, well, I know that I'm going to have such a good time talking about this with my friends. Maybe it was worth it after all. Maybe the collective bonding experience that was Cats has made me.
I think it's a similar thing to The Greatest Showman, isn't it? I mean, it sounds to me like, you know, it's a kind of self-conscious camp folly that people are gonna.
Oh, I don't think it's self-conscious at all.
Okay, no, I think Tom Hooper seems beaten down by this project. I think The Greatest Showman, I think, was the film that was supposed to be made, right?
And I think also Hugh Jackman is so kind of he knows what he is. He knows he's a variety entertainer of a man. He's not like, well, I'm actually Hugh Jackman, the serious actor. Whereas I think that Tom Hooper really thinks that he is I'm an artist, I'm an auteur.
And Hugh Jackman was in control of that project.
No one is in control.
No, this is a bit of a meta film.
I mean, it was, you know, that clip that you talk about with Tom Hooper on the red carpet looking like a shell of a man, essentially.
He said he worked for 36 hours straight for that final sign-off.
And then are you happy with how it looks, Tom? And he's very much happy.
Here's an idea for the future. If anyone's any film producers listening, Gus Van Sant Last Days-esque document chronicle of Tom Hooper's last 36 hours making Cats.
I like that.
I mean,
I even think a kind of Christopher Guest-esque, like the behind the scenes of making.
No, it's got to be dark. It's got to be like Abel Ferrara directing or something, or the Safdies.
So, Hannah, what scores are you landing on for this one?
It's hard giving scores to this film because do I give it scores based on how much I enjoy the thought of this film and the thought that people spent time and money and effort making it? Or do I give it scores on the piece of like absolute garbage filmmaking it is? I just gave Star Wars a 4-2-2, so let's go a 2-1-1. I genuinely think this is appalling and everyone should be embarrassed who was involved with it.
Okay, well, probably similar for me, 2-1-1, but then this is really not my sort of bag. I know that maybe people will really enjoy this, and I'd love to hear from people
there's a story, I think on, I can't remember which website it's on, if you Google it, it'll probably come up, about the lost adaptation of this film that Steven Spielberg was trying to mount in the 90s, I want to say. He wanted to do an animated version, I guess, kind of like a little bit Disney-esque. And I think that would have worked completely. I think that's what the source material needed.
There's still time. Just give it 20 years.
Yeah. There is actually a Judy Garland animated film from the 60s called Gay Paris, where she plays a cat. And it could be one to seek out. It's quite good, actually. Oh. On that note, just before we go into Little Women, to say, I always find that I'd much rather see a one-star film than a two-star film, just to recap on the discussion so far. So, you know.
Will you go and see Cats with the family?
I think I might do, actually, yeah. Again, I like to keep tabs on
If you could send us
Tom.
A voice memo, I'm sure yes. we can
You've
put it out
You've got to keep tabs
feed.
On him. You've got to know what he's up to.
Tom Cat.
So that was Cats and The Rise of Skywalker, both in cinemas this week. Up next, we have a preview of a film that's coming out on Boxing Day, and that is Greta Gerwig's take on Little Women.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Greta Gerwig follows Lady Bird with this adaptation of the classic novel in which four sisters come of age in America in the aftermath of the Civil War. Let's hear a clip.
This is Meg, Amy, Beth, and Joe.
I intend to make my own way in the world.
No one makes their own way, least of all a woman. You'll need to marry well.
You are not married, aren't you?
Well, that's because I'm rich.
Joe, would you like to dance with me?
Can't because I scorched my dress.
And Meg told me to keep still so no one would see it.
I have an idea of how we can manage.
A little clip from Little Women there. David, should we be excited about this?
In a word, yes. Uh-huh. I think while Tom Hooper is in the dock, I think that Greta Gerwig should be put forward for a sainthood for this movie. So this is her third directorial film mm-hmm. after... Nights and Weekends, which she made as a little kind of mumblecore collaboration back in the noughts, the mid noughts, and then obviously she sort of went full bore auteur with Lady Bird, which got lots of Oscar traction, and you know, it was next big thing moment, and a film which I liked, and emphasis on the word like rather than loved, and I went to this with. You know, I was unsure of how it was going to go. I think it's kind of a bold passion project for the director, and I think it's a film it's one of those films that you kind of you earn the right to make, rather than, you know, you have to have a kind of decent success to be able to make a kind of opulent literary adaptation like this. And I was just like in raptures throughout. Like, I mean, it was a film where every scene, every frame, every line just hit home, and it was a kind of a story, and the way it's been realized, and the sort of general sort of bittersweet, very melancholic tone of the film is just handled so beautifully. So the story is that you've got Jo March, played by Saoirse Ronan. She's an aspirant writer who is parlaying her life story and the story of her sort of family relations into these tales that she's selling off to a kind of local rag newspaper, and they're kind of buying them up but sort of suggesting quite heavy edits on them. And then we kind of follow her back to her sisters, played by Emma Watson and Florence Pugh and
Eliza Scanlon,
and mother played by Laura Dern. And then you've got this kind of romantic foil. He's kind of a dastardly romantic foil from next door, played by Timothée Chalamet, who's very, very good. And it's kind of like watching this family evolve through time. It sort of plays hard narrative very lightly. It uses Gerwig's kind of adaptation. The book adds some time switches where you're kind of moving back and forward in time and seeing moments connected together through time, which works like amazingly well. And like her use of like seasons and production design and light, just every scene anchors you in a moment in time. And like when you see it connected to other moments in time, you just really get a feeling of like, oh, that moment is lost forever and we're moving on to this other thing. And it's also about memory as well, in that it's this blessing and a curse, and things happen in your life that are gone physically but are with you forever. And in the end, the film is about this kind of tragic position of the artist being saddled with this responsibility of what to do with these memories of like joyful family life. I just loved it.
It's really remarkable, because so much of the marketing around this film, of course, Greta Gerwig coming off Lady Bird, which was such a hit with those youngsters on the internet, and of course they've assembled the Avengers of stand-em,
yes,
here with Saoirse Ronan, Timothée Chalamet, Florence Pugh. You know, even the older folks like Laura Dern, very hot right now with certain audiences. But it seems like there really is something there. Hannah, what did you think of the film?
I was very sceptical. I mean, I love Lady Bird, but I think the trailer for this kind of gave me... it just seemed very safe and quite nicey-nicey, and I'm not a big period drama fan, so there needs to be something to kind of draw me in. And even that cast, I don't like Emma Watson as an actor. I don't think she's very good.
I left her out of that list.
Yeah, I'm not a... I'm not a Chalamet stan at all. He's fine.
Even after meeting him?
Well, yeah, I met him. So we recorded a little video, which will be going live hopefully very soon. We did a little interview with Saoirse, Greta, Florence and Timmy. And Saoirse and Greta, two of the most charming, lovely people I've ever met. Florence is nice. Oh. I think she was very cold. There seemed to be some sort of...
Temperature-wise or mood-wise?
Temperature-wise, she had to go and change because she got a skirt on and she went and put trousers on. I think she was cold. Bless her. Timothy, I mean, maybe it's an age thing, because I'm like 5 or 6 years older than him, which doesn't seem like a lot. But when you're in your kind of a... He's like 22 and I'm 27, and maybe we're just at different points in our lives.
Were you interviewing him the day when all of the female members of the cast and crew looked incredible?
Yeah,
and he was wearing a grungy
t-shirt.
Old Gorillaz t-shirt.
Yeah, really, you know, much to think about. I mean, I think he's very good in Call Me By Your Name. And I thought he was pretty good in Beautiful Boy, even though that film has been widely decried by many. I like that film. But The King, I thought was terrible. I thought he was woefully miscast in that. But I actually think in Little Women, he's very good. He really comes alive in this cast. And I think a lot of it is because he has really great chemistry with not only Saoirse, but with Florence Pugh. A lot of his scenes are with Florence, and they work so well together as Amy and Laurie. I think they really... whenever they weren't on screen, I was like, go back to them in Paris. I want more of them. I think they really have a good chemistry. But also, he just looked like he was having fun, which I don't think Chalamet often looks like he's having fun in these films. I think that next year in June, he's probably going to not look like he's having much fun. I think he's quite a serious young actor.
Right.
Whereas the character of Laurie is so kind of foppish and buoyant. And I think that really does kind of come across in this. And I think the one thing I would have liked more of was Louis Garrel's character, Friedrich Baer, who's the kind of other great love interest in Joe's life, who I think we don't really get a kind of convincing reason as to why she would decide to marry him in the end. I don't think it's a spoiler. The book's very old. But yeah, I was genuinely surprised at how much I liked this film, having not really been that enthusiastic about the prospect.
I'm enthusiastic about it. I've not seen the film yet. One thing I can't really get a sense of, within all this hyperbole, I do love many of the actors. Saoirse Ronan and Florence Pugh really are just God tier right now for me in terms of young actors. In the annals of the period drama, if we want to use that term, what sort of film is this like? Is it like Sense and Sensibility, where it's drilling down to some sort of essential wit and humanity? Is it like Love and Friendship, which is putting an auteurist spin on it? Is it something more classical than that, David?
Do you know what? The film that it reminded me of, in fact, the two films that it reminded me of that are both very different in that they're very much more tragic movies, it's Scorsese's Age of Innocence and also Terence Davis' House of Mirth,
right?
Which are two like very very sort of tales about tragic women, but it's more this idea of like that there's something very cinematic about these adaptations, in that like Scorsese, Terence Davis have they've almost like consumed the essence of the books. And this idea of adaptation is fascinating for me, because it's like you've got adaptations that are like, okay, they're very academic and they're like, this is what people say this book is about. Here are its themes. Mm-hmm. We need to create those themes in the book. I think great novels are ones that there is sort of like lassitude in how you can interpret them, and you can build your own takes on them, and you can create your own focal points. And I think that these set of films, including Little Women, you really get a sense of like, this is a take on the book. This is like someone who really cares deeply about these words, these characters, and has interpretations about what they mean, the import of their actions, and how they translate, and how important like nuance is as well. There's nothing about this film that feels like, oh, I've like cut and paste words and just put it into a script because, you know, we need to get link this scene to that scene. It's really about like every scene is like working towards something bigger, and actually the film feels very like a singular thing. It's almost machine-like in that everything is working towards this kind of single idea. And I think the same thing is for like Scorsese, Terence Davis. They're like, you're getting this essential essence.
Essential essence.
You're getting this essence of meaning that in itself is like, you know, almost teasing you between like, this is the book, but this is my book, you know?
Right. Well, what score would you give this then, David? Sounds like, is it 2-2-1 again?
Yeah. I'd probably say 4, because I wasn't necessarily expecting, like, you know, to absolutely adore this film, and I did, so 5s.
Wow.
2 5s. I'm just like, I think one of the other things that has really boosted my enjoyment of this film is watching how much David enjoys this film. I hear a little while, as we generally, I say broad strokes, the editorial staff agree about things. But when Adam or David, I think I am a more sort of like enthusiastic critic than David and Adam sometimes, maybe because I haven't been beaten down by life yet.
True.
But whenever I see David or Adam like pop off about how much they love a film, it really warms the cockles of my heart.
So when I come back to the office and I'm like, Alita Battle Angel absolutely rips. Okay,
that didn't warm my heart, because then I went and saw it and was like, what?
So yeah. Are you going to piss on his chips now, Hannah?
No, I'm not. No, not at all. I think actually it's one that I really want to watch again, especially after watching the other two films we've done this week. It's like a 4 in anticipation, maybe a 3/4, just because I was quite apprehensive. A 4 enjoyment and a 4 in retrospect, which might go up to a 5 depending on a rewatch. I do think it's such a warming, like a hot toddy of a film. It really is like a tonic in these kind of cold, unforgiving times. And a great film about like loneliness, specifically the kind of loneliness you feel as a young woman moving to a big city and not knowing anyone, even with this kind of, it's this great taboo that you can have a loving family, a very supportive family, and still feel so deeply
disconnected,
alone and disconnected. And I think that that's something that I don't often see articulated in cinema, and it's really lovely to feel a film.
I think the analogue is something like Judy Garland in Meet Me in St. Louis. That is that it's Judy again.
Oh yeah.
But she, you know, it has got that same vibe. If you know Meet Me in St. Louis, which is like, you know, one of the sort of classic Christmas movies, it's like it's family life, but then you're focusing on this person who just is confused and disconnected and slightly kind of depressed about the future.
And how fitting for us to end on a Christmas movie there, David. Yeah. Like we planned it. So, listeners, if Cats or The Rise of Skywalker don't really do it for you, it's good to know that Little Women is just on the horizon, coming out on Boxing Day. And that's our lot for this year. We'll be back in January with the usual big hitters and deep cuts. David, Hannah, thank you so much for joining me this week.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm Michael Leader, and as always, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.